Vantage. If Edith had worried that George would expect playful banter again, she needn't have. He began, as she later imagined he began all business negotiations, by throwing her off balance. Mrs. Heron, I should tell you right off that our meeting in the coffee shop was no accident. I sought you out deliberately. His words were strange, but his tone was genial, and Edith was too surprised to feel alarmed or even to notice that he'd called her Mrs. Heron when she had never told him she'd been married. What do you mean, sought me out? You mean you saw me in the coffee shop and decided to approach me? But I'm the one who spoke first. No, I mean I came to Antioch expressly to speak with you. I intended to simply knock on your door. My excuse was going to be that I wanted to put relatives up at a local hotel or guest house and needed to see if yours would be appropriate. But when you came out of your house and started walking, I got out of my car and followed. I was about to start up a conversation when you saved me the effort. Edith felt her pulse quicken. She moved her chair a few inches away from the table, and with her eyes measured the distance from where she sat to the front door. It was only 5 o'clock, not even verging on dusk yet. Surely if she screamed, someone would come. You followed me? She said, keeping her voice steady. He smiled. Please, I meant no harm then, and don't now. A while back, a young assistant at my workplace mentioned this town and your guest house specifically. He and his family stayed here for a week last summer. He told me how pleasant it was, how tight a ship you ran. It surprised him that a woman could run a business so efficiently. He said you were smart, and he described your house to me in some detail. He told me that you were a young widow, a former nurse, who had opened a guest house after the death of her husband. By the way, please accept my condolences. Edith ignored this. You're saying you knew all of this about me when we spoke in the sandwich shop? I did. Why? Why did you seek me out? Why didn't you tell me you'd come to town in order to meet me? First, I needed to see if you would do. First? What could be second, then? Her imagination raced toward multiple possibilities, each scarier than the last. She pushed her chair back and stood up, her breath stammering inside her chest. I think you should go. Let me explain, please. Edith shook her head and started for the door. You should go now. She gripped the doorknob, but her hand froze, refused to work. A frightened sob started in her throat. Edith, I don't hurt women, George Graham said, speaking quickly. I save them from men who do. Or I try to, at least. Not by myself, of course. I rely on other people, good people, people who believe women should feel safe in their own homes, people who can keep a secret. I was hoping you could be one of them. Even though she had no idea what he meant, his voice was so urgent and earnest that it stopped Edith in her tracks. She didn't yank the door open and run out. Instead, keeping her hand on the doorknob, she turned around to face him. What does that mean? Come, sit back down at this table with me and I'll tell you. When I'm finished, if you want me to leave and never come back, I swear to you I will honor that.
How do I know I can trust you?
You just know. The way I knew after we talked in the sandwich shop that I could trust you.
She took him in, his intense eyes, his hands, clasped now, on the tabletop, and she didn't so much decide to trust him as realize that she already did. All right, then, she said, nodding and walking back to her chair. Go ahead. I'm listening.
He called it a relocation system, a neutral and technical term for what sounded to Edith like a manifestly human, risky, and emotion-fraught enterprise. Most people think that what happens between a husband and wife in a private home, no matter how unjust or dangerous, is nobody's business but theirs. But I make it my business, he said, his tone turning hard, and for a moment his affable exterior parted like a curtain so that Edith caught a glimpse of the person underneath, powerful and shrewd and used to getting his way.
You don't afford a suit like that by being nice, she thought. George's explanation was full of holes. He said that he identified women whose husbands were hurting them, but he wouldn't say how or where he found them. He told her that he had people in place, scattered in many different places, some of whom drove the women from point to point, some of whom gave them safe places to stay, usually for one night, but he declined to say who the people were. Where do they end up, these women? Edith asked.
Elsewhere, he said, his face inscrutable, and safe.
But don't their families look for them?
Of course. Sometimes the police get involved. The women who have children take them if they possibly can, so by some lights they're kidnappers. So far, though, and I try to keep track of those we've relocated for at least a year, so far no one's ever been found.
They leave everything behind?
Everything. Their names, their families, their jobs, their homes. Once they get where they're going, we furnish them with new ones.
New families? George smiled a brittle smile.
No. I would imagine that after enough time goes by, they might contact family members whom they trust, their parents or brothers and sisters. They shouldn't. We advise them not to. It's a terrible idea. But I would imagine some do.
There's something ruthless about this. And about you, Edith said.
There's a ruthlessness to any kind of mission, said George, shrugging. We get them away from their bastard husbands who could end up killing them. Is there a price to pay? I don't doubt that there is. But that's not my concern.
A shiver ran through Edith. To leave everything, everyone behind. She had no one to leave except John, but she had her house. She looked around at the walls, the photographs, at the house that Joseph had given her, traces of him in every corner, in the very air. She knew she could never leave it.
I can guess what you're thinking, said George, but not everyone is happy in their homes. For the women we relocate, their houses have become prisons.
Am I right in assuming that you want this house, my house, to be a stopping point in your relocation system?
It's in a useful location. Your neighbors are used to strangers coming and going. You are a private person with few real ties to your community. You have nursing skills.
Edith startled at this. Nursing skills?
Some of the women have injuries, of course, he explained coolly. Occasionally, the children do too.
Of course that would be true. She nodded.
I won't lie, he said briskly. What I'm asking you to do is risky. But you are just a cog in the wheel. You'll be given as little information as possible. First names only. Everything happens late at night or in the very early morning before sunrise. You won't know who drives them here or who picks them up. You won't even see the car. I noted a blank spot between houses at the end of your street. No street lights, no buildings. The car will drop them there, and, if possible, they will walk through the backyards, along the canal, and enter through your back door. No local people will be involved, and the women themselves come from far away. You won't know where, and you will never know where they go once they leave here. There shouldn't be a need to reach me, but, just in case, I will give you a number to call. A woman will answer at any hour of the day or night. You'll leave a message, and I will call you back. But again, this should not be necessary. This is a fine-tuned operation. If you do your part correctly, it will all go like clockwork.
What makes you think I'll do this?
Your mind gets restless. Isn't that what you said? I sense that you're a woman who would like to be part of something bigger than running a little place for tourists.
He shrugged.
And don't worry. You'll be repaid for any expenses you might accrue. Extra food, medical supplies. If you insist on it, I can even pay you a regular stipend, although most people act purely out of a desire to help.
His imperious attitude and his smug certainty that she would jump at the chance to be part of his plan annoyed her so much that she was tempted to say no just to prove him wrong. But he wasn't wrong. Edith heard Joseph's voice as distinctly as if he were sitting next to her.
You must promise to give yourself entirely to someone or something because that's who you are. You are a genius at devoting yourself. It's what makes you happiest.
Why don't you sleep on it? Said George.
I don't need to, said Edith. I'm in.
2 weeks later, on December 19th, 1953, a woman's voice, neutral, almost machine-like, on the phone, told Edith that the first woman, Margaret, would arrive that night, and, just after midnight, she knocked on Edith's back door. Shockingly young, possibly not yet out of her teens, with a gray wool coat that was much too big for her, clutching a cheap valise that Edith knew was probably full of things she'd only recently been given that did not quite feel like hers. George had said that many of the women left in a hurry, empty-handed, and an old, yellowing bruise on her cheekbone. Margaret stared at Edith with the wide, frightened, bewildered eyes of an injured animal, and on an impulse, even though she was not usually quick to touch people, especially strangers, Edith took the girl's free hand in both of hers, murmured, "Oh, sweet child," and pulled her gently into the house. Edith would learn that some of the women, and occasionally, heartbreakingly, some of the children, could not bear to be handled, flinching or pulling away at the slightest touch. Some recoiled when she offered words of sympathy. Some could not, especially upon first arriving, even meet her eyes. She would learn to move slowly around them, to change their bandages without comment, to offer them food with the efficiency of a waitress in a restaurant, and to wait for a sign, a hand reaching out, a cautious smile, the offering up of a small personal fact. "My mother has a clock like that one. I wish I hadn't left the book I was reading sitting on my nightstand. Can you imagine fretting about a book at a time like this?" That they wanted a more human connection. She would learn to take her cues from them. But that night, almost before she had stepped across the threshold, Margaret fell into Edith's arms and clung, her thin shoulders quaking with near-silent weeping. Because there were no other guests at Blue Sky House, Edith walked Margaret into the living room. When Margaret stopped crying and dropped, exhausted, into the chair Edith offered her, she said, staring into the fire, "He didn't even hit me that often. Only when he got really jealous. But it was always in the face. And once you get hit in the face, you're always waiting for it to happen again. Your body gets so tired from bracing itself for the next blow, and it gets so you can't sleep, and your mind can't focus on regular things anymore. Even more than the hitting, it was the waiting that got to me." For a couple of minutes, the crackle and hiss of the fire was the only sound. Then Margaret turned to Edith with a wry and weary smile. "Well, I always did want to get out of Roanoke," she said, "and here I am." Over time, Edith would find that, just like Margaret, despite their instructions to hide their history, most of the women would tell her where they'd come from, would let slip a tiny piece of what they'd left behind. She understood this impulse, this laying claim to a past. It was as if they were saying, "Despite my vanishing act, I am not a ghost. I am real, a flesh-and-blood woman with a story that belongs to me." After Margaret had gone to bed in the little downstairs bedroom, Edith got out a notebook and performed, for the first time, an act that would become a habit, documenting this woman's brief stopover in her own life, setting down, for no one's eyes but her own, a record of this person who would disappear. She knew as she wrote that it wasn't wise, that George would be angry if he found out, but she couldn't shake the conviction that everyone whose life brushed against her own should leave a trace, even if it was just a few scant, cryptic lines on a page. In careful, precise printing, she wrote the date, followed by this: "Margaret. Roan. Kontchuk. Auburn hair. Pale. Skinny inside her big wool coat. Freckles like sprinkled nutmeg across her nose."
Chapter 16. Claire. The night I found Edith and Joseph's marriage certificate, his obituary, and her photographs, Zach called me. Even though it was nearly 3 in the morning, I was still awake, or partly awake, floating under the blue sky of Edith's ceiling, in a hazy state not only between wakefulness and sleep, but between my present and Edith's past. In this dreamy space, it was oddly easy to feel that Edith was close by, not like a ghost or a guardian angel, but physically under the same roof as me. The way when I was a kid, I would lie in bed and know that my mother was in the house, feel the peace of that knowledge in my bones, even if I couldn't hear or see her. Even the buzzing of the phone against the bedside table didn't yank me out of this calm, Edith-is-near state, which is maybe why, when I saw who was calling, I didn't ignore it as I usually would have, nor did my heart start galloping like a spooked horse. I just answered. "Zack, it's really late," I said, quietly, firmly, just as Edith would have.
"I know,"
he said. His voice was a little high, a little loud and excited, but happily he wasn't crying and didn't sound drunk.
"I'm sorry, today when I was walking through the park on my way home, I saw this girl, maybe 8 years old, walking with her dad, and she was in a costume. This straw hat, maybe a boater it's called, with braids that might have been attached to the hat, or maybe she had a wig on, or maybe they were real, but anyway, red braids, pretty convincing, and this sort of pinafore dress and these button boots, and I flashed back to that miniseries you made me watch. I mean, yes, you made me, but then I actually enjoyed it a lot, the one based on those books you loved as a kid, and I walked up to her and said, 'Excuse me, but are you—'"
He paused, waiting. "Anne of Green Gables," I said, finishing his thought.
"Yes, and she said she was, and then added, 'Thank you for noticing,' in this very solemn voice, and I said, 'Are you in a play?' And she said, 'No,' politely, but also like she was a little miffed at my question. And her dad smiled and said, 'Yesterday was her birthday, and all she wanted was an Anne of Green Gables outfit, a real one, not a ready-made costume with Velcro up the back. So she got this. If she ever takes it off, it'll be a miracle. This kid lives and breathes those books. And the thing is, the truly amazing thing, Claire, and don't think I'm crazy, but her voice was totally a kid version of yours. And her eyes, they were your eyes. Big, brown, same shape, eyelashes, expression, everything. And if you remember, you said the same thing to me about those books, the exact same phrase that you lived and breathed them. So I took it, and I took her, this amazing kid who looked like she just time-traveled from the turn of the century, as a sign."
He paused, audibly winded. "A sign that you should call me at 3 in the morning? I said, not mad, still channeling Edith's firm, kind, implacable calm.
"Yeah, sorry about the timing, but it took me a long time to get my nerve up to talk to you about this, and I wanted to call before my nerve stopped being up, which would probably have happened sooner or later."
"I see," I said. "Well, you're talking to me now. What would you like to say?" I sat up, leaning against the headboard of the bed, and waited for him to answer, totally and surprisingly unracked by dread or anxiety.
"Let me come see you,"
he said.
"I can get on a plane tomorrow. I just feel strongly that we need to sit in the same room, or maybe take a long walk and have a conversation. No yelling, no accusations or insults, and I'm obviously referring to me here, not you, since I'm pretty sure you haven't raised your voice even once throughout this whole ordeal. We'll just be two adults talking. How does that sound?"
I waited for the impulse to run for the hills to hit me, but it didn't. "It sounds very civilized," I said truthfully.
"Doesn't it?"
"What were you thinking we should talk about?"
"I don't know exactly, but I think we should talk now that we've let go of all the anger. At least I have. I hope you have too."
"I'm glad you have. And I don't honestly think I had any to let go of. Lots of other emotions, I guess, but not anger."
"Good. Then it's all settled."
He sounded happy. More than happy. Jubilant.
"My flight arrives at 10:25 a.m., so I can be at your parents' house by 11:30 tomorrow morning. You want to go to lunch? Or I could bring lunch? You know what? I checked the weather and it's supposed to be nice, so how about a picnic? What do you think?"
His jubilation rose with every word, so that by the end of this he was almost singing. "Hold on," I said. "Your flight? You don't mean you already have a ticket?"
"Yeah, I do. Come on, I knew you'd do this for me. It's how you are."
I wasn't sure what he meant by this, but I didn't demand to know, as I might have done a few months ago. I didn't even feel particularly curious about it. Whatever insights Zack had or thought he had about my character, correct or not, they belonged to him. I didn't begrudge him them, but I also didn't need them anymore.
But still, I might not have actually bought the ticket, he went on. I don't know, when I saw that little girl that clinched it, I took a leap of faith.
Buying a non-refundable airplane ticket because you saw a brown-eyed girl in a boater hat at the park seemed like a dubious decision, even for a hardcore Anne fan like me, and for a moment I worried about Zack's mental state. But then I reminded myself, and I knew this from my own experience, that if you went out into the world looking for a sign that you should do something, a go-ahead from the great beyond or wherever, you were highly likely to find one. There was a time, even after our breakup, when I would have so dreaded bursting his bubble that I would have told him okay, hung up the phone, and jumped in the car to drive home. But there, in Edith's house, I could instead say, Zack, I think we should get together and talk sometime. But I can't tomorrow.
What do you mean you can't?
He said. I can't tomorrow.
You're what? Busy?
An edge entered his tone. Whether it was an edge of hurt or anger, I couldn't tell yet, but I knew I'd find out soon enough. I am, actually. I'm sorry, but I really am.
Claire, this is important, and it's all planned.
I know, and I wish you'd talked to me about it before you made those plans, because tomorrow doesn't work. Another day would, I'm sure, but not tomorrow. In the pause that followed, I could hear Zack taking deep breaths, trying to steady himself, something I knew didn't come easily to him. He tried. He always tried so hard to do the right thing. I wished he had the spirit of Edith there to help him. He might have needed her even more than I did.
Look,
he said finally.
I'm coming anyway. I have the ticket, right? And I don't need to come in the morning. I'll check into my hotel, and you can call me whenever you're finished with whatever you're doing, or whenever you have a break in your busyness. Tomorrow night, even. It doesn't matter how late, okay?
Zack, coming is just not a good idea.
Why? You can't squeeze me in? What if it were Hildy? You'd probably drop everything if it were Hildy. Can't you do that for me?
I can't. I couldn't if it were Hildy or anyone, because I'm not home right now.
You're away? Like, for a few days or something?
Yes, I'm away.
Well, on vacation?
Sort of, I said.
Sort of? What is that supposed to mean?
With each word, his voice rose in both volume and pitch. I held the phone a couple of inches away from my ear.
Where the hell are you, Claire?
No way in the world was I telling him. It doesn't matter. I'm just away for a while.
Wait. You're saying you won't tell me where you are?
I really just need some time by myself.
Bullshit!
He spat.
If you were alone, you'd say where you are. Who is he?
So much for letting go of anger. I'm not with anyone, Zack.
God, it's not Dev. Tell me it's not goddamn Dev.
I think I should go now.
Seriously, Claire? Your high school boyfriend? That's your rebound guy? You know that's pathetic, right?
I'm hanging up now, Zack. Please don't call me again.
Don't you fucking tell me what to do!
He was shouting. Zack's shouting had always shaken me. There was a note of something wild in it that reverberated all up and down my internal fault lines. But not this time. This time, without saying goodbye or a single other word to him, I hung up. Then went to my phone settings, turned off vibrate, put the phone down on the table, fluffed my pillow into just the right shape, and went to sleep. After breakfast that morning, in a small, locked box under the sink in the kitchen, I found the ledgers. It's how the world works sometimes, I guess. You spill your coffee, go searching for a sponge, and find a mystery instead. There were two of them, one leather-bound and official-looking, the other just a regular black-and-white marbled cover composition book, the kind with which I must admit I have harbored a lifelong obsession. Jokingly, but also not, Dev used to give me one along with a box of Ticonderoga pencils every Christmas, and the sight of the two together, a perfect pairing if ever there was one, never failed to satisfy completely a little part of my soul. Both ledgers were full of the same, almost typewriter-like printing I'd found on the back of Edith's photographs, so clean and precise that even though the blue ink was faded, I could read every word. Sitting at the kitchen table in a pool of brilliant morning sun, being careful to keep my coffee at a safe distance from the ledgers, I dug in. I started with the leather one, which turned out to be a list of the people who had stayed at Blue Sky House, their names, including the names and ages of each child, if there were any, and in the case of a few entries, the name of the family's dog, with its breed noted in parentheses, which made me adore Edith even more. The dates they'd stayed, and their home addresses. Most came from Delaware or from neighboring states, but a handful lived in places as far-flung as Ohio, Massachusetts, and North Carolina. At the tail end of most of the entries, she'd written what seemed to be reminders to herself. Things like, youngest child cannot eat eggs. Fond of watermelon. Tea instead of coffee. Afraid of the dark, needs a nightlight. And smokes dreadful cigars, but thankfully only outside, put ashtrays on the screen porch, evidently preparing for the possibility that the lodgers would return. I treasured the bits of Edith's personality that shone through. The plain, clear printing, not a curlicue in sight. The meticulous entries, every one with the same format, no crossouts or misspellings. The woman even spelled dachshund right on the very first try, a feat I never pull off myself. Every comma in place. Her thoughtful, almost tender documentation of her guests' loves and fears and allergies. And above all, the hope, on page after page, that they would all come back someday. The ledger's brown silk ribbon still marked the page with the final entry, the last guest. November 15th through 17th, 1956. Betty Brownmiller, 715 Chestnut Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Early bedtime, hot milk. All the remaining pages were blank, and I wondered a little sadly if Edith had known when she wrote those words that Betty would be the last guest ever to stay at Blue Sky House. Except that what I'd learned from the last page of the next ledger is that she wasn't the last guest. Even before I got to that page, I'd started calling it the Shadow Ledger. The Shadow Ledger and the Daylight Ledger are what the two became inside my head. The Shadow Ledger's entries were made in Edith's same, now familiar, printing and carefully dated, but that's where the similarities between the two ended. Where the Daylight Ledger was clear and direct and businesslike, the Shadow Ledger was cryptic and oblique and intimate. Where the Daylight Ledger was complete, the Shadow Ledger left almost everything, everything practical, out. No last names, no addresses. I even heard the words of them differently as I read. The Daylight Ledger spoke in Edith's voice, crisp and bell-like. The Shadow Ledger whispered. Margaret, Rowan, Kant, Chk. Auburn hair, pale, skinny inside her big wool coat. Freckles like sprinkled nutmeg across her nose. Kitty, farm, bns, bk, arms, I. Bergman cheekbones, husky laugh, nightmares. Alice, port, burr, herbs, clav, Kant, aber face, sang lullabies, voice like an angel, oval nails, Carolyn, dimples, topknot. Johnny drove a toy truck over the floors and up the walls. Janet, hemp, burr, tooth, Kant, face. Knitted while she talked, the needles clicking. Dove gray bobbed hair, sweater with acorn-shaped buttons. Peggy, 16, pointed chin, ballerina posture down to her turned-out feet, fierce brown eyes that bode well for her future. Carol, Joan, Dottie, Ginger, Linda, Mary, Joyce. Rich, and News, Char, Rich, Lou, Fred, Lynch, North. Aber, Chuk, Kant, Arms. Burr, Rad. Kant, Nk. Kant, Turnk. Eerdr, Rup. Swan's neck, blue-black hair, talks with hands, swore a blue streak, tall, dry humor, red lipstick. Yellow braids, Raggedy Ann doll. Math homework, chewed nails. Green eyes, penciled eyebrows. Loves movies, loves baseball, spoke in whispers. While much of what I read was code-like, inscrutable, what I could understand was so vivid it seemed to breathe. I found myself turning the pages gently, as if they were precious, as if they might dissolve under my fingertips, causing all the people in them to be lost. The Daylight Ledger had been interesting, but the Shadow Ledger made me feel that I was discovering something momentous, like the guy who found King Tut's tomb. One minute you're poking around in some rubble, and the next you're opening a door to a room full of gold. A few times in the middle of reading, I felt so excited that I had to go out and walk around in the backyard. Distracted by wonder and confusion, it's a miracle I didn't step off the edge and fall straight into the canal. My first theory was that the Shadow Ledger was a more personal version of the Daylight one, Edith's private take on the guests, an aside, like notes jotted down in the margins of a book. So when I'd finished reading the shadow ledger through once, I opened both ledgers and compared the two, entry by entry, date by date. But it didn't take long for that first theory to crash and burn, because for one thing, the daylight ledger began more than a year before Edith made the shadow ledger's first entry, and after that, while sometimes the dates matched up, the names never did. It was as if Edith ran two guest houses, one for people with full names and houses on specific streets in specific towns that they'd go home to, and another one for ghosts, mostly female ghosts. Only they weren't ghosts. Ghosts didn't have fierce eyes or freckles. They didn't love baseball or sing lullabies. I thought of Edith's photographs, how one small, chosen fragment of Joseph could evoke a whole man and a world of love between the photographer and her subject. In Edith's hands, the Shadow Ledger guests, despite being nameless and rootless, apparently untethered to the ordinary world, became exquisitely human. And what I believed, what seemed clear to me, was that Edith loved them, too, although not the way she loved Joseph, of course. What I kept picturing was Miss Clavell from the children's book Madeline. Edith, doing her duty, watching over, keeping track, not turning off the light until everyone was safe. I called Dev. I almost didn't, because even though I'd maintained my cool through the roller coaster ride of my dead-of-night conversation with Zack, the next day, I kept coming back to the part where he'd accused me of rebounding with my high school sweetheart. That accusation hit home just a bit. Not because I wanted to rebound with Dev or with anyone. God knows I felt as wrung out and done with romance as I ever had. And anyway, when it came to romance, Dev was definitely and forever off the table. But because what had started the day I'd sat at that enormous, glossy conference table with the equally enormous, glossy, in spirit anyway, Eloisa Dunn, and learned that Edith had given me a house, was an adventure. A true blue, strange, astonishing, bona fide adventure. And the person who'd always had adventures with me, my longtime partner in crime, or what passed for crime for two hopelessly goody-two-shoes kids, was Dev Tremaine. I hadn't actually spoken to him since the wedding that wasn't. He'd followed up his wedding cake-devouring photo with a text that simply read,
"I'm here if you need, you know, wisdom or whatever. And by whatever, I mean anything. But you knew that already."
And then he proceeded, apart from the occasional goofball text, to keep his distance, Dev having always been a person who got without being told when a person needed a little space. The night of the day I found out that Edith left me her house, when I was still too stunned to talk about it with anyone apart from my mom, who'd been with me when I got the news, Dev sent a text that said,
"So get this. This guy I met last week in the sandwich line at Wawa, he just bequeathed me an island. A small one, but still, a whole island."
I laughed, out loud no less, and texted back, "Always with the one-upsmanship." To which he responded,
"Wait. Are you saying you inherited something far less impressive than an island today, too?"
Even though I can see how some people wouldn't like it, he was my ex-boyfriend after all, I'd always found it comforting, Dev's and my being part of the same information pipeline, his knowing things about me without my having to tell him. Even though we hadn't talked about it, I was sure he knew I was staying at Edith's house, just like I knew he was working in a lab at UPenn for the summer, ate lunch at a North Philly falafel place every single weekday, and on Sunday afternoons played on a men's basketball team that included his former high school biology teacher and his best friend, and my best friend's kind of but not really at least not yet boyfriend, Aiden. Neither of us found it weird, and neither of us ever did much with the information we had. We just knew stuff about each other's lives. It was how it was. How it had always been. But anyway, I almost didn't call him because I didn't want to give even the tiniest bit of credence to Zack's rebound accusation until it hit me how stupid and childish this was. "What the hell, Claire? You what, don't want to give Zack the satisfaction?" I said to myself. "He won't even know." But then I reminded myself that Zack's knowing or not knowing wasn't the point. The point was that Dev was my friend. He answered by saying,
"You would not even believe what I'm eating right now."
"Falafel."
"Not falafel. The greatest falafel in the world."
"The greatest falafel in the world is in Philadelphia? What about the entire Middle East? What about the falafel in Baghdad?"
"Better."
"What about Dubai? I bet they have really great falafel in Dubai."
"Not this great."
"Is it the tahini?"
"It's the tahini, the falafel itself, the tabbouleh bread, it's everything.
Can't you just say pita like a normal person?
Who would say pita when they can say taboon bread?
Everyone?
Anyway, it's not really a pocket. A pita is all about the pocket.
Can we stop talking about your lunch now?
Yeah, sure. Stop when I was winning.
Winning the conversation about your sandwich?
You had no comeback to my pita pocket observation. It was painfully obvious.
You're painfully obvious.
And we end with another classic Claire Hobbs counter-insult.
Turning your own words against you. You'd think you'd know better by now than to argue with the likes of me.
You'd think I'd know better by now.
I never think you'd know better.
True.
Can you just shut up at this point? Is that possible?
Yes.
Dev, listen.
Listening.
This morning, I spilled my coffee and went looking for a sponge because I thought maybe Joliet had left one. Joliet like the city, not like the Shakespeare heroine. She's the woman who cleans the house. And so anyway, this morning, coffee everywhere. So I went looking under the sink for a sponge and boom.
Boom?
Yes. But it really started before that when the nosy neighbor mentioned the murder and I went to the library, which was the most consummately perfect library ever, with this amazing red door and full of rustling like I like, and I sat there and read through nearly 121 copies of the Daily Bee, and I had to do some piecing together, and it took me hours, although thank God they had all the newspapers digitized a while back, and when I was finished working, I looked up and was surprised to see it was dark outside, and my eyesight was doing that underwater thing that comes from staring at a computer screen for too long, but it was all worth it because the story, Dev, it was amazing. Do you have time to hear it? Like, is your lunch break almost over? Because I can call back later.
Did you say murder?
Yes.
I can stay later at the lab if they need me to. Tell me now.
I told him everything. My conversation with Joliet, my conversation with Louise Smith, the two canoes, Joseph's photos of Edith, Edith's photos of Joseph, the marriage certificate, the obituary, the story of Elliot Giles's murder, of John Blanchard's trial, and of the disappearances of Edith Heron and Sarah Giles. The blue ceiling, the percolator, everything. I ended with the ledgers, opening them up and reading Dev a few entries from each. After I finished, Dev was quiet for a while. I could feel the wheels turning inside his head, and even without seeing him, I knew exactly the expression he had on his face. Finally, he said,
I guess we're thinking the shadow guests were real people? She couldn't have been, I don't know, taking notes for a book she was writing or something. Or maybe they were just people she met someplace else, like at the beach or in a restaurant or someplace, not people who stayed at her house.
I never thought of that. I guess it's possible they weren't guests or even real people at all, but I think they were. There are the dates, for one thing, placed a line up from the guest's name just the way they are in the daylight ledger, and the two ledgers were together in the same box, like they were the same sort of thing, a pair.
A pair,
he echoed.
Okay, that's true. Plus, she makes reference to lullabies, right? And nightmares? There are at least two guests with nightmares at the end of their entries, which seem to indicate that Edith was with them at night. People just don't sing lullabies or have nightmares out in public, and since Edith owned a guest house, chances are they were guests.
Yes, also. I stopped, my cheeks flushing.
Also what?
Okay, not to sound crazy, but they just feel real to me. Real and like they were here, in this house. Maybe it's the details Edith includes that brings them to life for me, but I look around and picture them so clearly, here on the first floor where there's a tiny bedroom where I bet they slept. I see them knitting and running a toy truck across the floor and singing to a baby. There are these two chairs by the fire, and I can see women sitting there, the firelight on their auburn hair or blue-black hair or... I sighed. So, yeah, it does sound crazy.
Not to me, not really. Brain scientists actually take intuition pretty seriously these days. And even if they didn't.
Even if they didn't, what?
I take you seriously.
Well, thanks, I said, sincerely flattered. Dev cleared his throat.
So let's go ahead with the idea, at least for now, that the people in the shadow ledger were real guests who stayed at Edith's house, but who for some reason warranted a different ledger and a different, harder-to-understand kind of entry notation. They were like an undercurrent, this flow of shadow guests, or like Edith's own little parallel universe.
I started smiling at let's go ahead with the idea, and as the excitement mounted in his voice, I pumped my fist in the air and shouted a silent, celebratory yes! Because he was back. My adventuring partner, gung-ho to grab my hand and jump with me feet first into mystery. Shoot, if only we could find them, I said. Those shadow guests. Some of them, especially the kids, are sure to be alive someplace, but there's just not enough information to go on.
No, but listen, listen,
said Dev.
Some of them weren't there alone, right? There were other guests, daylight guests, who stays overlapped with theirs.
Yes, a lot had overlapping dates, I said. More in the summer than in the winter, when she probably didn't get that many regular guests. The Shadow Ledger goes on for about 3 years, and I haven't counted, but I'd say there were 20 or more times when the Daylight guests and Shadow guests overlapped.
And we do have information on those guys, the Daylight guests. What if we get in touch with them and find a way to ask them if they remember other guests being there? Then we'll know for sure that there were two sets of guests.
Oh, wow, right, I said, catching on. And who knows, maybe they'll remember something about those guests, something that might give us a clue as to why they were shadow guests, what made them shadowy instead of daylit.
It's definitely worth a shot. We shouldn't expect too much, though. Some of them won't live at those addresses anymore. Some of them, honestly, might not live, period. And if they're still around, they'll be pretty old. They may not remember much from way back then. But you know what? Some of them had families, so maybe the kids will remember something if we can track them down.
How, though? Should we do one of those reverse search things online? We can put in names and addresses and try to find phone numbers or email addresses. It's kind of a stalkery thing to do, but we could.
We could,
said Dev.
But we could also just write letters. Blue Sky House is in Delaware, and I'll bet a lot of the addresses are pretty close by. Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, Philadelphia, or around there. We could say, I don't know, that you inherited a house that used to be an inn and are trying to learn more about its history. Not a lie, just not the whole truth. Most of the letters would either get where they're going overnight or in a couple of days. We could give the people our cell phone numbers, and they could call us if they have any information.
A fair number are Delaware addresses, and most of those are in Wilmington, actually, where you live. I even recognized one or two of the street names. I had a thought. Hey, you might even know some of the people, Dev, or their kids' kids. For a city, Wilmington's a pretty small town.
You're right. So why don't I start with them, the Wilmington people, and you can do the others,
he said.
We can start tonight, even.
Tonight. Suddenly, we were 13 years old again, gangly and sure of ourselves and full of an almost feverish urgency to begin. But how will I get you the addresses? I asked. It would also be good if you had the Shadow Ledger entries that correspond with the dates of the people you're contacting. I could type it all up, I guess.
You could, I guess,
said Dev. There was a silence, during which I was pretty sure the two of us were thinking the same thing. Yes, I could type up everything and send it, which would take a while, especially since there wasn't internet service at Edith's house. Or Dev could come to Blue Sky House. He was spending the summer in Wilmington, splitting his time the way he usually did between Cornelia and Teo's and his mother's houses, taking the train into Philadelphia to work every day. Wilmington was a scant 2-hour drive from Antioch Beach. He could be here tomorrow morning, or even tonight. I knew just how it would be. The two of us sitting at the kitchen table with the ledgers spread open in front of us, Dev's face alternating between pensive and animated in the glow of his laptop, his eyes as full of streaming, darting life as a coral reef. We'd type and leaf through the ledgers and now and then break the quiet to voice ideas that would seem random to anyone else, anyone other than two people who'd been following the stone-skipping trails, bounce, 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 of each other's thoughts since they were kids. It would have been so easy to ask him to come. But at the very last second, something held me back. I don't know what. I felt not ready, although for what, I couldn't exactly say. Not ready to not be alone in Edith's house? Not ready to not be alone, period? Not ready to be alone with Dev? But that last possibility made no sense, so I discarded it. Still, the fact remained that I didn't feel ready to invite Dev to Edith's house. Not yet. Not quite. Just as I was about to say I'd type everything up, go to the library or a coffee shop or something and send it to him, Dev said,
What if you take pictures of the relevant pages with your phone and text them to me? That'll save you some work and save us some time.
I let out my breath, even though I hadn't realized I'd been holding it. Good idea, I said. In the end, over the course of a week, we only got 3 phone calls between the two of us, but they were enough. We confirmed what I'd known in my bones to be true. The shadow guests were real and had stayed in Edith's house. One man had been 9, and he remembered getting up early and coming downstairs before his parents woke up. There was a girl sitting in a chair reading a book. She was about his age, maybe a little younger, with dark curly hair. He remembered that she was embarrassed about her dress because it wasn't pretty and was too big for her. She told him that the dress was borrowed and that all her own pretty clothes were back at home. He remembered her mother showing up and telling her to shush, and he wondered why her mother seemed mad when all the girl had done was talk about her dress. According to the Shadow Ledger, the girl's name was Elaine, and her mother's name was Dottie. Another man, nearly 90 years old but sharp as a tack, had stayed with his family at Blue Sky House 3 times. He described Edith as quiet and gracious, the kind of person who could produce a bucket and spade out of thin air for the children to take to the beach and who packed a hell of a picnic lunch. On the 3rd visit, he and his wife Anne woke up in the middle of the night to the sound of someone sobbing her heart out, so Anne had gone down to check on Edith. But when she got to the 1st floor, Edith was standing in the living room, dry-eyed and composed as ever. She told his wife that a guest staying in the downstairs bedroom had had a nightmare, but that everything was all right now. By the time his family came down to breakfast the next morning, the guest was gone. According to the shadow ledger, the guest's name was Kitty. Another woman had been around 15 when her family spent a weekend at Blue Sky House. A chronic insomniac, she'd been unable to sleep and was lying awake when she heard doors opening and shutting on the floor below. Worried and curious, she'd crept down the stairs to see what was happening and saw a woman with 2 black eyes, terrible-looking, swollen almost shut, standing in the kitchen. She remembered being surprised because she hadn't thought there were any other guests staying there. The next day, she expected to see the woman at breakfast, but even though the girl could hear someone moving around in a back room on the 1st floor, the woman never appeared. When the girl told her mother about the woman and her black eyes, her mother decided that Blue Sky House must attract a lower class of guest than she'd thought, and they never went back. That shadow guest's name was Mary. During that week, Dev and I talked every night about what we'd taken to calling the Blue Sky House mystery. Pure Nancy Drew, I told Dev gleefully. And about other things, too. I even told him about my breakup with Zack, although I knew he'd probably heard much of the story already. I hadn't realized how deeply I'd missed this when Zack and I were together, putting my phone on speaker and letting Dev's voice be my company. The night he told me the story of the woman with 2 black eyes, I went to bed, tossed and turned the light on and off, tried to read 2 times with no success, until I was struck so hard by an idea that even though it was well after midnight, I called Dev. Before he could even eke out a sleepy hello, I said, "What if Sarah weren't the first? All this coming and going in the middle of the night or early morning, that girl wearing borrowed clothes as if she'd left in a rush and hadn't had time to pack, the 2 black eyes? The Shadow Ledger is obviously keeping a secret. It's kept it all these years. What if the secret is that John Blanchard and Edith were running some kind of escape route, an underground railroad for battered women?" Out of breath, I waited.
"You might be right,"
said Dev.
"Claire, I bet you're right."
My eyes burned. My mouth trembled. When I touched my cheek, I discovered I was crying. "I think I am," I said.
"Are you crying?"
asked Dev. "It's just that, well, I'm lying here in her house, you know, and I'm thinking, who does something like that? Because it would have to have been risky, right? Back then in the 50s especially. And I met her, this brave person who did this thing, and I talked to her, and now I'm in her house. This house that she gave me that all those women and children passed through. And I miss her so much. I wish she were here so I could talk to her and do something nice for her, give her something. And I will never be able to."
"Maybe you are,"
said Dev slowly.
"It could be that this is what Edith wanted, for you to find out her story. Maybe this is the thing you're giving her."
Startled, I wiped my eyes and considered what he'd said. "Do you think it matters, though? Edith is dead. Can it possibly matter when she's not here to know about it?" And Dev said,
"Yes."
Chapter 17. Edith. June 1954. 6 months in, John found her out. When she thought about it afterward, after Alice and her children were gone, after John came back and stood on her porch for the 2nd time in 2 days, as close to truly angry as she'd ever seen him, and said, "I hope to God you know what you're doing, Edith," she realized he had been bound to find out sooner or later. Because if John Blanchard were good at anything, and he was good at many things, it was paying attention. Also, and perhaps more significantly, he loved her. How far that love went, Whether it crossed over from simple friendship into the territory of being in love, she wasn't sure, and he never let on. But she knew this. John Blanchard was her best friend, and he loved her. He loved her and looked out for her, and, moreover, seemed instinctively to understand when she was sad or worried or hungry for conversation or for the matchless, soul-nourishing camaraderie of laughing with another person. So when she began keeping a secret from him, it made sense that he would know this, too. The June night that Alice and her two children, a one-year-old girl and a five-year-old boy, were to arrive at Blue Sky House, Edith was more nervous than usual. She'd gotten word the night before that because of some kind of safety concern that forced them to leave the place they were coming from, wherever that was, they would be arriving earlier than was usual for downstairs guests, as Edith had come to think of them, at around 10 o'clock, instead of after midnight or just before dawn. Fortunately, there were no upstairs guests booked for that night, but 10 seemed so early. Some houses along her street, as sedate as the street was, would no doubt still have lights on. People might even be out, walking dogs or coming home after a late dinner in a restaurant. To distract herself from worrying, Edith kept busy, tidying up the already pin-neat downstairs bedroom, getting the chicken out of the oven and carving it. By now, she knew that the women who came either had no appetite or were ravenous, and if they didn't fall asleep immediately, the children would almost always eat. By 9:45, though, Edith was so jittery that all she could do was sit in a kitchen chair and watch the clock. At 9:55, a knock at her door, the front door, not the back, scared her so much that she jumped out of her chair. Alice must have gotten her instructions wrong. Heart drumming, hands shaking, Edith opened the door, ready to hustle the three of them in as quickly as she could. But it was John. He wore street clothes rather than his uniform, and in his hand was a book about birds he'd borrowed the week before. His smile vanished as soon as he saw her, and she knew he'd noticed, as of course he would, her flustered state. "Hey," he said, taking a step toward her, concern in his eyes. "Are you all right?" Edith brushed her hand over her hair and forced out a laugh. "Oh, my. I guess I was lost in thought when you knocked, and it startled me nearly out of my skin. How ridiculous I am." She stepped out onto the porch, trying to keep outwardly calm, while inwardly, she sifted frantically through her options, the best of which seemed to be getting rid of John as quickly as possible. "Are you sure that's all?" he asked. "Well, the truth is I feel a bit feverish. I think I'm getting a cold, and I would hate to give it to you. There's nothing so crummy as a summer cold, is there?"
"I'm sorry you're not well. Want me to run out for anything? Orange juice? Tea? Cold medicine?"
"You're so kind, but no. I'm all stocked up on, well, just about everything. Now, you should go before I infect you."
But John stood his ground, and just then, Edith heard a faint knocking on the back door. John heard it, too. He craned his neck, trying to look past her, through the house. "Was that knocking?" he said.
"Oh, I don't think so," she said, glancing over her shoulder.
The knocking came again, this time louder. John's eyes met hers. "There's someone at your door, Edith. Are you expecting someone?"
"Well, I..." She paused, her mind racing. "You know, some guests were supposed to arrive this evening, but they never did. I bet that's them."
"At your back door? I didn't see a car drive up."
"Oh, it happens that way sometimes. You know how people can be," she said airily. "I should really go and let them in. I'll see you soon, John."
She turned to go, but John's hand stopped the door from shutting behind her. "I don't feel good about this," he said. "I think you should let me go see who it is." He stepped into the house just as the back door opened and a tentative voice called,
"Hello? Is anyone here?"
And then sharply,
"Johnny, come back here!"
Footsteps, and then a small boy with dark hair and a toy truck in his hand appeared, running toward them through the house.
When he saw them, he skidded to a stop at the edge of the kitchen and stared open-mouthed. "Hello," said John. He smiled and crouched so that he was eye level with the boy. "I see you've got a truck there." Mutely, the boy nodded uncertainly, but then a second later, he held the truck out for John's inspection. "It's a dump truck," he said. "You can put stones in it. Or dirt. Johnny, darling." A woman with a baby cradled in one arm stepped out of the shadowed living room and into the light. John stood up when he saw her, and at the sight of him she froze, her eyes darkening and darting from John's face to Edith's. She touched a hand, a long, beautiful hand, to her lip, which was swollen and crusted over with blood, and then moved it to her bruised cheek. When Johnny ran to her and threw his arms around her legs, she winced with pain. "It's all right," said Edith softly. "This is my friend John. I told him that sometimes guests make a mistake and come to the back door." The woman drew herself upright and gave John and Edith a smile with her swollen lips that would break anyone's heart. "Please forgive my mistake. Johnny ran around back before I could stop him, and I saw the door and just knocked. So thoughtless of me." "Don't give it a second thought," Edith said. "It's fine, just fine."
"I just stopped in to drop off this book I borrowed," said John, giving the woman his kindest smile and handing the book to Edith. "I'll make myself scarce now."
"I think I'll walk him out," said Edith to Alice. "Please make yourself at home." Out on the porch, as soon as the front door was shut behind them, John turned and said, "Edith."
"I told you it was just my guests," she said, meeting his serious blue gaze.
"And it is. There's nothing to worry about." John lifted his hand toward her, as if to touch her arm, then shook his head and let the hand drop to his side.
"I'll be back tomorrow night," he said. "We need to talk."
The following night, he stood on her porch again and said this.
3 days ago, at the station, we got a wire, one that went out to all the police stations in this area, to be on the lookout for the wife of a high-ranking military man in Portsmouth, Virginia, who had left in the middle of the night with her two children. Despite the June mugginess, a chill went through Edith.
"Oh?" she said as casually as she could. "Why this area in particular?"
"Apparently she has family in Kent County. It seemed possible that she would take the children there, but she didn't, and is therefore still at large."
Edith swallowed her sigh of relief. Blue Sky House was safe, at least for the moment, but there was still John to contend with. "At large? Sounds more like a missing persons case to me."
John shook his head and said grimly, "She's considered a kidnapper. That woman is a fugitive, Edith."
Keeping a cool head was obviously her best hope of deflecting John's attention from the goings-on in Blue Sky House. Edith knew this. She really did, but still her temper flared. "A kidnapper? They're her own children, aren't they? And tell me this, John, has it occurred to anyone that if a woman takes a risk like that, she must have her reasons?"
John sighed. "Edith, the woman and her children who came to your back door 2 nights ago matched the description of Alice Finlay and her two children exactly, down to the curls on that little boy's head."
Edith averted her eyes, staring off through the porch screen to the yard beyond. Her azaleas were having an especially good year. It was dark outside now, but in the daytime you could barely see the leaves for the pink riot of flowers. "Did this description of yours mention her fat lip, the bruises covering the entire left side of her face?" she asked quietly, her eyes on the azaleas. "Did it include her broken ribs and collarbone?"
"No," said John.
"Of course not," said Edith bitterly. "So I don't see how it could possibly have been the same woman."
"Are they still here?"
"You came to arrest them, is that it?" she said, clenching her hands into fists. "That broken woman and her baby and her little boy." John took her arm, gently, a kind, light touch, but she twitched it away.
"I don't think anyone really wants to arrest Alice Finlay," said John.
There are all kinds of prisons, she snapped. So answer me. Is that why you came? To take that woman and her children back to theirs? I came to see if they were still here.